Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mowell, and I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all. And
today, ahoy, ahoy.
We have a special guest, Mr. Kabad Al-Khalil. Kabad, can you please introduce yourself for our audience, please?
Sure. So thank you, Jack. Thank you, Ben. So Jack and Ben are colleagues of mine at work, and excited to be on your podcast. So as you said, my name is Kabad or Kabod Al-Khalil. I am an engineer in the ag space. I guess our company will remain nameless.
Audience knows who we work for, right, Ben?
Okay, right.
They have to know.
I think we've mentioned it. Yeah. That's okay.
I'll let them connect the dots. So I am an engineer. I was born in Iowa City. Lived in the States my first 7 years, so in Ames, Iowa. I also lived overseas, and I'm originally from Chad. So both parents are from Chad, and I lived, I guess, in Africa for a while, in Europe, and in the U.S. So I'm a hodgepodge of a whole bunch of cultures and languages. So, yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Real quick, so I always say your name Kabad. Is that is that correct or incorrect? Or
so growing up, people in school called me Kabad, but at home, I'm called Kabod. So that would be the proper way of saying it. But I think it's been going on for so long that I guess, and I'm also used to it. So, but okay. I've been trying to correct people. So now people are confused.
So Kabod.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. I can do that. I remember one time, I can't remember who it was. It was like when we were working with each other. So real quick for everybody, Kabod was when I joined our company, in my first role, Kabod was like my main mentor. So that's how I know him. Ben, how do you and Kabod know each other?
So we actually met through his twin brother, Mahawish, who was in the same group that I started in. And he preceded me by, I think, 11 months or something like that, 9 months. And so he was someone who had a little bit more experience, and could kind of help walk me through, like, here's the stuff you need to know, you know, early on in your first day, your first week, your first month, and so on. And we just built a friendship out of that. And yeah, known each other for a long time since then.
Okay.
And he also works for our company.
Yes.
Yes.
And
the company that we own. That's why we call it our company.
Yeah, yeah. And Kabod, you and Mahawish are twins. Are you guys fraternal or identical twins? Because I know look very, very similar.
So that is actually an interesting and timely question. For the longest, we thought we were fraternal until maybe a year ago. So we both did the DNA ancestry, or 23andMe. DNA test, and it came out that we share 99% or so of our DNA, and it said that we are identical twins. But my parents have been saying for the longest that we're fraternal. So I guess at this point, I don't know what to believe. I don't know what their error is in terms of percentage of DNA shared. But you would think that, right, anything above 50% or even above like high 40s would be considered, right, like. If you're 99%, I mean, the likelihood is that it's true, right? Like, because normal siblings only share in the, like, between 40 and 50-ish.
Hmm. Actually, you know, that brings up a question. So I would think, right, like the DNA test that you guys took, if it was about 50-so% shared DNA, then you know that you guys are siblings. I think is how it works. But then you hear stats like, oh, you know, chimpanzees share 90% of our DNA, or like 98% of our DNA. So it's like, well, hold on. If my own brother would share only 50% of my DNA, how does a chimpanzee match 98% of my DNA? And I am assuming that there's two different metrics that they're using to mean by match. I just don't know what those are. Because I think when you're talking about siblings, it's like you share alleles in common. But I don't know then how they would come up with, like, you know, a chimpanzee shares 98% of our DNA, or like, I've heard like another metric, like bananas and humans have like 60% of the same DNA. So basically what they're trying to say is you are more genetically related to a banana than your own brother, is how I'm interpreting that statement, and nobody can convince me otherwise.
You know what? I hope that they were using different metrics.
I think this is my interpretation. I could be wildly off base here, but my understanding is that in the conversation about humans and chimpanzees or any other animal, it would be like the order or the sequence of the genes doesn't matter. It's just saying if you look in both sets, you can find 98% of the material in this other library, basically, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas for like genetic relationship between siblings or family or whatever, you would actually be looking at, the sequence would actually matter, where you'd be matching like specific sequences of genes.
Mm. Okay.
In order.
I like that analogy, right? Like, so basically we share with the chimpanzees 99% of the chapters, but the content of the chapters are going to be different. And so with Mihawish, my twin, we probably share 99% of not only the chapters, obviously, or 100% of the chapters, right, and 99% of the content of the chapters.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good way of putting it. Hey, we solved the whole genetic mystery.
That's right. Where's our Nobel Prize?
We found over the course of doing this podcast for a couple of years that the way to solve problems is to not have any expertise. You just pull ideas out of a hat willy-nilly, you throw them out there, talk them through until they sound good, and then you solved it.
And importantly, no peer reviews, right? It's just us in the bubble of the podcast, and we say we've come up with a solution, and that's the end of the conversation.
Logic can take you a long way.
Yeah. Logic can also lead you in the wrong direction. There's a lot of unintuitive things out there.
That is true.
At work, it happens all the time, right? Where you say, well, it makes sense that this would be the solution. Then you try it out. It's like, whew, that went way in the opposite direction.
Yeah, go ahead, Ben. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say, we actually had, for a period of time, we were fact-checking ourselves and like looking stuff up in real time. And then we had listeners who told us that it slowed things down too much and made it boring. So we've stopped fact-checking. We said people don't care about the truth. They want entertainment. And so that's what we're doing.
Was that multiple people, or is it just like one person?
One person said it, and another person in the room seconded that opinion. So, yeah.
Now, I would agree as well.
It's easier for us.
And not having the pressure of having to be right, right? Like, I think that's how people don't even start.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
What's the saying? Perfection is the enemy of something. I can't recall.
Completion.
Or progress. One of those. Yeah. So sometimes it's better to just start understanding you won't be perfect.
Yeah.
That's actually... Go ahead. I was going to say, I think one of the catalysts for us getting started was that we had a friend who came to small group for a few months, who is like some sort of communications, like digital communications major at UNI. She was talking about how there's this app out there where you could record your podcast on your phone and publish it for free to all these different platforms. And so in my mind, I kind of built it up as like, if we're going to do a podcast, we got to get all this equipment and it's going to be all this overhead. And then basically this person said, yeah, you don't need any of that. You can do it on your phone and it's free. And so the excuses kind of disappeared because it was so easy to do.
Mm-hmm. That actually, so the, you mentioning like the, what's it called? The startup costs of like, oh, we need all this equipment. It's going to take a lot of work. I don't have time to do it. But then discovering, actually, we can go into this with nothing but a phone. That reminds me a lot of when my friend and I started our lawn mowing business, because all we had were like push mowers that our parents didn't really need anymore. So we ended up like, that's, you know what, let's just start with that and go from there. Now, the danger was we got so used to that, that we didn't bother ever getting any more important, bigger equipment to, you know, expand or whatnot. And only in our last year before we sold it, did we actually get employees to help us expand and whatnot. And then we ended up selling it. And then all of a sudden my college GPA went up, you know, shocker. But right, if you go in with like, we're just going to start it really easy. The danger with that is you get too comfortable with the low tech stuff and then you don't actually really grow. But right now, look how we're doing it now. We have like, we're recording it over like with better sound quality than a phone, which I think is definitely, and we have a social media presence, which is important. So I think we're doing like as technically advanced as we should right now. The only thing maybe I could think of is if I also get like a desk microphone that you, like you have been, but beyond that, there's not really a whole lot that I think we would, need to do right now.
Jack, I think with your engineering salary, I think you can afford a couple of those, I would say.
I think so, but my lethargy is what's really getting in the way, because I would have to research what microphone to get, then actually order it, then it gets here, I have to unpackage a thing, then I have to set it up, and say, oh, my headset works just fine.
That's fair.
Yeah, I've kind of stalled from getting any additional equipment until, I think I'm content with our level of production quality until it starts to be monetized. If and when that happens, then maybe we'll have another conversation, but
yeah.
I don't see that happening. So,
and so maybe it's a good question, segue into a question that I've had, I guess, before we started the podcast is, how did you guys even get into podcasting? What's your journey been like?
I know, I think I touched on it a little bit, but it just started with Ben and I having random conversations and getting really deep into it for an inordinate amount of time and depth in like group settings, and then everybody would be looking around at us saying, hey, we need to get back on to whatever we were doing. And we did that enough times that people just said, hey, you guys should start a podcast because you guys can just kind of talk about random stuff. And that happened enough over long enough to the point where, as I said earlier, I was motivated to do it just to shut them up, because then they say, hey, you guys should start a podcast. Say, yeah, well, we have one. So there you go. Leave us alone.
Yeah. I feel like we, in those days, we would be kind of talking off to the side, but we would often have two or three people who were just kind of standing around listening to what we were saying in the room, and they wouldn't really jump into the conversation. They were just like, wow, the things that cross your guys' minds are like, not something that would cross my mind is the short way of putting that. But. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think we kind of endeavored to ask the questions that we're interested in, whether they're significant or completely trivial, and then just hash it out until we're satisfied with the depth of the topic, whether that's five minutes or 2 hours. And yeah, we've had some pretty fascinating discussions.
Just recently, one of my favorite episodes as far as like material that we've covered is if the moon were really made out of cheese, how much cheese would there be and how much would it be worth? It was a pretty interesting conversation, and we didn't look anything up, but we did break out like a calculator with our own estimates to be like, how much would that, if it wasn't made out of cheese, what cheese would it be made of? That was actually a really interesting conversation, because as Ben said, a lot of people would say Swiss, because there's, you know, it looks like holes. There's holes in the moon, holes in Swiss cheese, but then Ben made some pretty compelling points as to why it wouldn't be Swiss. And I would discuss it more, but one, our listeners have probably already heard that. And two, you know, Kabod, that would motivate you to go check that episode out.
That is true. So now I have to go check it out and see what y'all talked about.
It's a very engineering-esque conversation, because we were talking about, you know, like the quantities and converting volume to value of cheese and stuff. And it was good. We had a lot of fun.
I think that's right up my alley.
Yeah.
We wrote down our assumptions at the top of the paper too. So
awesome. So another thing is I'm also into content creation. So videography, photography. Do you guys have a North Star in terms of what you plan on achieving? Do you guys have like recurring touch points where you guys maybe do a little bit of introspection or retrospection to try to understand where you're at relative to that North Star, or Or is it just more of a creative outlet to just a medium to have these conversations recorded?
So my first comment would actually be a editorial comment for the listener that North Star, maybe you're familiar with that concept, but I would say that's also one that has reached a level of corporate jargon within our company where we use, but the meaning is the same, but it gets used a lot. And all it means is it's like, what's your vision for the future? That thing that's keeping you true to where you, the direction you want to go, which is what the North Star did for navigation for centuries. And I think I would say we do have a vision, but that vision is one without any ambition whatsoever. So the vision is basically to meet, to continue to generate topics, and to just enjoy the conversations that we have and then publish it. And so it doesn't, it's not like we're really, I mean, we pay attention to what our audience size is and who's listening, and we try to, you know, advertise on social media pretty, whatever's free, I guess I would say we do. But it's not like we're setting any targets or like really striving for growth or anything like that. It's more just kind of ad hoc and trying to keep things casual and not too high pressured or effort filled.
Yeah, I would agree with Ben. We started this podcast just because people said, you know, we should, and I thought it would be a good outlet for us to have these conversations and maybe relieve the pressure off of those. Whenever we do meet in person and don't have to have the conversations then, because we've gotten it out of our system, that is not what happens usually. We just keep having those conversations anyhow. And, you know, we'll do, you know, I wanted to be on a consistent cadence, just be like, hey, if we're going to do a podcast, if you're going to do any sort of content creation, which I haven't been into, but I've watched other like YouTubers on their content creation will occasionally say, hey, because I'm a content creator, here's what I have to do to stay successful. And just over time, you know, I've learned their tips and tricks. One of them is to do things consistently rather than sporadically. So that was one reason I was like, hey, you know, we might as well be consistent at it. Plus, we had, I think, two or three instances where we went months, if not even closer to a year, between episodes sometimes. So I was like, you know, that's really way too infrequent, sporadic. Like, we do have to, if we're going to do this, we should do it at fairly regularly, if not completely regularly. And the 2-week cadence is really convenient for us for that reason, because even though we release episodes every 2 weeks, we don't always record them 2 weeks apart. Sometimes we'll do like 2 episodes in a few days of each other, and we will release the first one a few days after, and we always release it at the same time every week. But then we'll release the second one 2 weeks after that, even though we recorded it before the first one was even published. And we do that just to keep the cadence of publishings regular, because the listeners don't know when we record, they just know when we publish. So keeping the cadence of 2 weeks publishing lets us be really flexible to when we do a recording, which is what Ben and I have to worry about.
I
can't remember if I had anything else to add, but I talked long enough.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think maybe answering a question behind the question to some extent, for those who are content creators or artistic creators in any sense, I think there can be a lot of pressure to turn it into something productive, a side hustle or, you know, your main job or whatever. And I think it's important for everyone who's creating anything, whether it's a podcast or video or whatever, to remember why they're doing what they're doing and what they want to get out of it. Right. Because like I already said, if this podcast never makes a dime, I'm perfectly content with that. I don't want to get money out of it. And to some extent, for me personally, when I start trying to earn money from something that I do, it takes all the fun out of it for me. And so, you know, I, I do photography as a hobby, and that's something for a long time people told me I should sell my pictures, I should do these different things. Like, oh, people would buy that. And it's like, okay, that's great and all, but I don't enjoy the effort it takes to advertise or start a business, to advertise it, to actually, you know, find a supplier who could print the pictures or canvases, whatever. I just want to go take pictures and, you know, enjoy the beauty that I see around me. Like, for me, a camera is more about capturing what I see and having a memory of something that I saw that was beautiful or interesting than it is about conveying something to other people. And so I think that's, I guess for me, a guiding principle behind the podcast is that we need it to always continue to be what we want it to be and what we're hoping, and that we're getting out of it what we hope to, not trying to make it into something that other people tell us that it should be.
I think you both brought up some great points, and I've heard the whole you know, when you monetize, it takes the fun out of it, and I've heard that because rather there's more stress, more expectations. I guess while both of you were talking, I had another something was coming. I had another thought there around you may not be looking for monetization, but another thing that, for example, I would be looking for doing a podcast would be to improve my like public speaking skills or improve my moderating skills. And so my question also revolved around one thing that I want to touch on was, are you guys frequently like listening to your content to try to improve your delivery, you know, maybe the different segments that you have, et cetera, or I hate listening to my voice, so I generally would not rewatch anything. But I was wondering if y'all did.
Ben, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, just briefly, I don't typically re-listen to episodes unless there's something in particular that I'm looking for. But I would say that I do keep my ears open for feedback from people who I know are listening. So we've made tweaks, and I think we mentioned some of them before we started talking, but, you know, doing things like we used to record on our phones, and now we actually record from home offices with better mics and headsets and that kind of stuff. We used to do some real-time fact-checking with Google searches, and we were told that that was kind of slowing the pace and boring, so we cut that out. So, yeah, I wouldn't say that I do self-scouting with it, because for the same reason, I don't really like listening to my voice, but that would be an interesting topic of why we don't like our own voices. But
that's a good topic.
That is a good topic.
But all that to say, I do try to pay attention to what other people say, because if there's something that we can do that's relatively low effort to improve it, then why not?
I know I actually do listen to our episodes, and I only started doing that recently, I think like this spring. And I primarily started doing that just as a quality assurance sort of thing, quality checking, to see how our mic qualities are. Is there any, are we talking over each other way more than, you know, I think we are? Is my delivery, could that be improved somehow? Like, are we talking too fast? Are we talking too slow? Is there something, more technical stuff, like did something haywire go wrong with the sound? Like, did did the recording get corrupted or something? And, you know, if we don't re-listen to the episode, we're not going to know. I know we've gotten some quality complaints before, like Ben's voice, I think, was really quiet relative to mine for a stretch of episodes. And that came in before. That was one of the reasons why I started doing the quality checking, because we didn't know that for like a few episodes in. So I was like, oh, we should probably work on getting that checked out. I think I haven't learned anything too much about how I can change my own delivery, except for maybe just being careful about not talking over Ben. But that's something that I've been working on outside the podcast too. So I can't remember if I ever thought that I was having that problem. And Ben doesn't do that. So
I think part of that is also y'all are both great at delivering. And probably why you both gravitated towards, you know, you choosing podcasts as an outlet. But just a guess.
It could be.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. I would say also that I don't necessarily listen to podcasts regularly, but I have found a handful of other podcasts that I enjoy that sometimes I'll listen to if we're on a long road trip or just kind of in the background while I'm working. And so I would say because self-scouting is one element of it. So it's like, how are we doing with what we're trying to do? Like, are we hitting the mark that we're aiming for? And then there's the other component that is, what is the mark that we're aiming for, right? And so benchmarking other content creators. So there's some streamers that I watch either live or on YouTube, and just kind of for my own entertainment, but I feel like I've picked up some of the ways that they introduce topics or structure their show or whatever, stuff like that, that maybe you've had some subconscious effect, but I haven't like taken notes or like intentionally tried to derive useful methods from their approach.
Well, that's great, and I don't want to be the person that hijacks your podcast, but I have another question.
You're a guest. That's what you're here for.
Okay, well, appreciate it. That also revolves around the same topic. In terms of podcast editing, do y'all use AI for editing, maybe to cut out the ums or the silences?
I don't think we typically have too much silence in the
That's episode. True.
We don't. It's kind of like you just wind us up and watch us go for the duration of whatever we record. But no, our editing since we've started has been, with one exception, it has just been listen to the first few seconds of the clip to find where the conversation starts and trim off the dead air on the front end. And then we'll do the same at the back end, trim off the dead air at the end. And then it's just basically one solid unedited block in the middle. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if the topics change pretty clearly, I'll split that up into multiple segments so that you can listen to an individual segment with just one topic. If you only have, 15 minutes or whatever, you've got a nice stopping point where you could see, that you could come back to their topic later.
And to interject really quick, there's no audible cue in the podcast for that. You're just talking when you look at it on your phone, it'll say segment one, topic, whatever goes to this point, and then segment two, topic, whatever starts at that point. And kind of like chapters in a YouTube video.
Yep. Right. Yeah. So you could just start playing from the second topic if you already heard the first one. But
I'm actually going to check.
It's audibly seamless.
I know that Spotify will show you the segments, but I listen to our podcast when I'm doing the quality checks over Pocket Casts, not Spotify. And I don't think that they do the segments. I think that gets lost in that one. Let me check. I'm just checking the last few that we did. And I'm not seeing segments. So
no lookups, Jack.
Fudge, you're right. Dang it.
Okay.
I broke our one rule. I brought shame on my family.
I have another question. Again, back to being a twin. I know we talked about the genetics. Another topic being a twin, people always try to find differences, among twins. And in trying to do so, I think twins also end up being generally like in some aspects opposites of each other, right? Sometimes you tend to find one that's more social than the other, one that's better at sciences than the other, one that's more athletic, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe that's something a topic that we can explore further, and I can play the role of being a twin, not even playing the role that I am a twin, yeah. and y'all can look at it from an external standpoint.
So you're saying you're talking about where the twins will either intentionally or subconsciously divert themselves from each other just to obtain some sort of sense of like individuality?
That may be part of it. It's just, I think, an observation when you look at most twins, in certain aspects, they're polar opposites.
Real quick.
So why is that?
I don't know if this applies. Actually, I think it might be a counterexample of what you're talking about, but there was an example of like, these twins that were separated at birth. I don't know if it was intentional, like as part of a study, or if it was by accident, but they both grew up to have the same profession. They married, they were dudes. So then they each married women with the same name. And there was like one or two other really creepy, like any one thing is like, it's just coincidence. So it was like four very, like, there's statistically no way that would have happened unless they were like, you know, there's something weird with being twins. So they lived very, considering that they didn't even know each other, they lived eerily identical lives. But that was, so, you know, that could be, sure, the odds of any, like, one set of twins, meaning that those, like, matching up that well is really crazy small, but maybe they are the one time that happened, in which case, yeah, we would probably expect that to happen once or twice in the world.
Yeah, I was going to say, the other way to look at that is how many, since you said they are male, how many men share four of the same attributes? Mm-hmm. And then what percentage of the population in general are twins, right? Mm-hmm. And so you could run those numbers, and I would imagine there'd be actually probably more than one pair of twins who shared at least four attributes in that regard.
But the Kabod raises a good point where, well, the twins intentionally divert themselves away just so that it's like, well, I don't want to take this, you know, I know that my brother became a doctor. So, you know, I really want to become a doctor, but, you know, is that just me being a twin? You know, I'm going to go do something else. Whereas if that, you know, so I can see them knowing each other, which is going to happen with most twins, actually playing against that trend. So in other words, the results you get don't match up with your expectations.
And then there's the property brothers.
The property brothers. Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, is that like the HD, not HGTV?
HGTV.
Yeah. Okay. I know what you're talking about.
So what I was going to say, though, is I think to do this properly, Kabod, we need to have Mahawish on as well so that we can hear if you actually both think the same or the extent to which you disagree. So what I was going to propose is that we hold that topic, or we can have some of the conversation now, but have both of you on in a future episode and talk about that topic.
I'm okay doing that. Maybe one thing that I will share, because Mihaj and I have had this discussion, and even with my parents, and Jack, you brought up a good point. Do twins intentionally do that to be different? Because, right, like everything people tell them, you're always told, hey, y'all look the same, you know, and people try to find similarities between you, and so maybe it's an effort to differentiate themselves. But I think part of it is also twins, I think, subconsciously living other people's truths, as far as let's say growing up, people tell you, okay, Mihaj is better at math than you, or is better at playing soccer than you, and then you hear it so often that you tend to like internalize it and live it, right? And I think I'll give you one example. So growing up, when you were little, we used to share a room with Mihawish, and my dad, Mihawish, I think, would wake up. My dad told us, but Mihawish used to wake up in the middle of the night and cry. My dad would come and pick him up, take him with them. I'd wake up in the morning and I wouldn't find Mihawish, and I'd go find him with them. And as a kid, especially as a twin, you'd be like, oh, why do they love him more than they love me? And as a reaction, you tend to do stuff to create attention. And so what does that mean? You tend to break stuff, you tend to act a little erratic so that, you know, you also get some love. And I think what happens oftentimes is the parents or the people, the adults would then tell you, hey, you know, Mihawish is the good kid, Kabod is the naughty one. And you hear that so often that you tend to then actually live it. But it actually started off as maybe a cry for attention. Right. And so what my dad did is he would let me have you sleep. As soon as he fell asleep, he would take him back. And then that's when I stopped, right, like acting erratic. So I think part of it is when my theory is why we see so many twins that are divergent is because at some point in their lives, like stuff like the, like this happens, and as parents or people, adults around them, you have to pay super close attention to these small things, and be careful with the words you choose or with, right? Anyway, so maybe a topic for another day, but I'd love to explore this topic a little further, and maybe have a larger sample size more than greater than one to draw some conclusions.
You did bring up a really interesting point as far as like child rearing goes, though, and I think this principle that I'm going to bring up would apply to, you know, single kids too, but it would probably get amplified to when you have siblings, where just the act of Mahawish as a baby waking up middle night and crying for whatever reason, I mean, it could have been something like, which is interesting in and of itself in your situation, because you guys share, you know, almost completely the same DNA. So why would, and when you're a baby, you haven't, one, had much developmental factors to override your genetics yet. Two, you and Mahawish both share those same developmental factors because you're babies. I would assume that you two are rarely apart or ever treated differently. So it brings up the question, why was he waking up in the middle of the night consistently, but you weren't? That's an interesting question. But then the principle I'm trying to get to is just something that small for, hey, the baby's waking up in the middle of the night, let's bring him into the bed so he can go to sleep, snowballed into now the other kid is a problem child.
And so we were actually a couple years old. So we weren't babies, or maybe four, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. So at that point, the thing is, like, all it takes is just for it to happen once, you're realizing the positives that come out of it, and then you're repeating it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's crazy that that small of a thing can actually change the trajectory of, like, a lot of twins.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that came to mind as you're talking about that is that I don't think those dynamics may be the most pronounced with twins, but I think those dynamics still exist with all siblings to varying degrees. And another thing that came to mind is that I have a friend who has, he and his wife have three children. Their oldest is a boy, and then they had twin girls. And they've talked in the past about how different the girls are in terms of temperament and like eating habits. One of them will eat everything that's put in front of them, and the other one's super picky and like won't touch certain stuff. And it, to me, maybe there's explanations for it in like epigenetics, but there again, if you have the same genetic makeup or almost identical and the same environment, how do those things come to express themselves differently? And I guess the two things that I take away from that are, I was just watching a YouTube video a couple of days ago about mathematical, what's it called? Like non-determinability, which is basically like, even if we knew all the physics of the universe, we still couldn't fully predict like where every particle would go in a system of gas or something like that, right? Like, even if you know all the inputs, you still can't perfectly predict a system. And so I think that's at play, but I also think there's an element of, or in my personal opinion, I would say that the fact that two people with so similar DNA and so similar of an environment can come out so differently is an argument for the existence of something more than just the physical universe, that there's drivers behind our behavior and our personality and our preferences that are non-biological in origin. That's my theorem.
That's deep.
It is. This rabbit hole goes deep, my friend.
It does. I definitely can see how y'all can, you know, stretch this for an hour.
it relates also, I think, to, kind of going back to Kabod's example, it relates to chaos theory too, because what chaos is, chaos isn't defined as randomness. it's defined as like an extreme sensitivity to input conditions or initial conditions. And so you could have, you know, two genetically identical twins that were raised in the same way, but then at age four, you change this one thing where one of them gets carried into the parents' bed at night, but the other one doesn't. And then that quickly snowballs into two wholly different sets of behavior. And there are some really good visualizations of this on YouTube, where one I saw recently is they just had like this semi, it was like on a computer program, it just had this semi-circle of a ramp. And what they did was they dropped like a, they bunched up a bunch of particles kind of off center from, and then just dropped them. And they were all like apart from one each other by like, oh man, like millionths of I guess a diameter. So they were all pretty much right on the same spot, but not they were just a little bit offset from each other. I mean, teeny tiny. And then as they would bounce, it first looked like they were all right on top of each other still, but then you slowly start to see them diverging because the little differences in position, bounce to bounce, it compounds on one another. And not long after, all these little like bouncy, like simulated bouncy balls are just all scrambled about. Very essentially erratically and random. And the point that these visualizations are trying to make is you can have the same environment, you can have the same stuff being changed by that environment. You know, it's just the same bouncy balls that have the same properties, all being tossed about in this semicircular, I guess, ramp or bowl. And the only difference between them is that their positions were offset by this stupidly small amount. But then over time, you see how that expounds to, wow, these are all behaving completely different from one another. Hence chaos. And hence, maybe that is also another reason why people who have the same genetic makeup and nearly identical environments and developments and being raised can still act wholly different later on in life. Because although their environments are really, really similar, there's the little differences that could snowball these different behaviors. So that could be another factor playing into it too, is just chaos theory.
Yeah. Who doesn't love a great metaphor? I love that metaphor. I think it explains it well.
I would look it up and show it to you guys, but we can't.
But we can't look up.
Can't look things up. I can't hear the term chaos theory or chaos without thinking of Jeff Goldblum's iconic portrayal in Jurassic Park.
Oh, where that's
he's just like, chaos. Just keeps repeating the word chaos. You say chaos enough, you've got chaos theory.
Chaos. And I remember watching his demonstration of that in the movie, because I loved Jurassic Park as a kid. So I watched it quite frequently. And I remember it had something to do with like a drop of water on your hand or something. And every time I watched it, I was like, what the heck is this guy talking about? Even I understand, like, this is a horrible visualization for chaos.
That also reminds me of, I was doing training once. This was a day long class that I took with our company. And there was like an icebreaker team discussion where each person in the room had to like suggest something that they felt was like the most significant invention in history, or like the most significant achievement of mankind or something like that. And so people were talking about like printing press or the internet or whatever. And I said, well, we've, on at least two occasions, we've been able to revive the line of dinosaurs using DNA that was trapped in amber. And basically just like retold the plot of Jurassic Park as if it had actually happened, and as if that was the crowning achievement of humanity over the course of our history. It was pretty fun.
Did anybody catch on?
Oh yeah. Yeah. They okay. were chuckling by the time I was done with it.
Okay. Hold on, that's a good tangent to go on. What would you seriously answer would be the most important invention of mankind?
Invention or achievement, or either?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, let's go with either. Let's spice it up. Kabod, I'm going to you next, so get thinking.
Sure, I have something in mind, but
oh, you do?
If you got something, go for it. I'm still thinking.
Yeah, I would say the pyramids. And I'm sure there are things that are a lot more important, but just it is fascinating that you know the math and the science behind it, and how we were able to build something of that stature that long ago time ago. And I'd have to look up
aliens. That's right. Ben, actually, I think it was the last time Ben and I had a guest on. We talked. The topic of that day was how we don't give ancient people enough credit. Where, and I don't mean to, this may sound like I'm attacking your position, Kabod, but bear with me. Where, when we do say, oh wow, how did people so long ago do all this stuff? You know, it must have been, you know, as Ben pointed out, some people say it must have been aliens, or there was some ancient civilization that was more advanced than we are today, but they died out and disappeared, and that's how they're able to do it because they helped them. And our guest, and it was Ben's brother, I believe, said, guys, they were human beings like us. Like, look what we can do. Like, sure, they may not have had the same technology, but they were just as smart as us. And they knew a lot of techniques that we today don't. We have to give them more credit. They weren't dumb. And we see signs of that, too. Like, they were able to do that. The Romans had better concrete than we did up until, but even recently, until we discovered how the Romans had concrete that way outlasted our stuff, even though we had so much more material science knowledge. How did they beat modern, you know, civil engineers out? They did. We know that they did. But, you know, we didn't understand how. And I think a lot of times when we say we don't understand how, we assume, oh, there must have been, it wasn't them. They don't deserve the credit. They were too dumb. There had been some outside force that delivered it to them. And we had a good long discussion about why, you know, we should give them more credit than they're getting right now. I kind of just pooped on your answer.
No. I mean, like, to me, I think I just find it fascinating, but I would agree with all of your points, right? Like, I think we don't give enough credit to the civilizations that preceded us. And to your point, there may have been civilizations that were more advanced than we were knowledge-wise, and we just maybe don't have any traces or any, like, actually we don't know about them. And so.
Yeah.
So maybe building off of that and kind of talking myself into a decision here, I think the accomplishments of civilizations that have come before us, I think pretty much all of them have had some sort of a writing system. They've documented knowledge on tablets or on papyrus or whatever it might be. And so I think the thread of what has been, what connects humanity's greatest achievements, and I think there's stages to it, has been the documentation and distribution of knowledge. And I think you could say, like, probably the biggest one in modern history would be the printing press, right? Enabling the distribution of books broadly across the world at much lower cost than they had been before. And then our most recent modern equivalent would be the development of telecommunications and then eventually the internet. I think those several things connected together, it's technology advancing, but the idea is the same, which is making knowledge available as broadly as possible, as cheaply as possible, and giving whoever in the farmost flung corner of the earth access to the combined knowledge of the entire human race, basically, right? Like, that's something previous civilizations didn't have available to them, that we know of, I should say, I guess. But I think that's what's really allowed us to accelerate our growth, is that, you know, I think as we talked about a couple of episodes ago, you don't have to solve the same problem over and over again. You get a solution to a problem, somebody solves it, and you can move on because that is documented and distributed. And so each successive generation can solve new sets of problems instead of resolving the problems of the previous generation.
Right. I like your approach because a lot of people might say the internet or the printing press, but you have the more nuanced view of they're not different. They're not so much different, you know, achievements or inventions as much as they are different means and, you know, a series of means to achieve the same end, you know, more efficiently than the last step in the series. And it's that whole series that you focused on. I like that. Plus, it makes it
And I think
more, I was going to say, it makes it more like, how do you gauge the importance of the internet versus the printing press? You know, the context of their invention, of when they were invented, is so different.
right.
Their effects at the time, you know, how do you, it's like comparing apples to the process of designing computer code. Like, where do you even start?
It's like the discussion of who's the best in a sport, right? When they played decades apart. They never played each other, right? And it's
Or
like, well, how can you can compare stats, but it was a different time, they changed rules, whatever, right? And so it's an interesting thought experiment, but it's not really a fair assessment. But I
I was
think
gonna say too, it's like, or even asking the question, who's the better athlete, Michael Jordan or
LeBron James.
no, like Tiger, like Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods. It's like, well, they
Oh,
to
sure.
play two completely different sports, like how, or even like, you know, who's the better athlete, like Michael Jordan or Bobby Fischer, if you consider chess a sport. It's like, well, okay, one of them is not even a physical sport, you know, anymore. So
Yeah.
it's
Now,
yeah, I think that weird comparison is when you ask this question, is it kind of comes into play.
yeah, and I think the knowledge piece of invention is what underpins all the others, right? So if you want to talk about the automobile or internal combustion engine or airplane or whatever, all of those things were enabled by the existence of the printing press, right? And so I think that underpins a lot of our significant accomplishments throughout human history.
So maybe to differentiate between, I guess, each one of these phases, which one resulted in the highest delta, right? The highest like progression, right? That then we can kind of maybe decouple all of these.
You could argue it's the first time that anybody developed a writing system because that was the first giant, you know, it's one thing to go from propeller driven aircraft to jet aircraft. It's a whole nother monster to go from no aircraft to an aircraft. You know, the first, the like the Wright brothers just like discovering how to actually generate sustained flight, because there was a whole, they weren't the first, it's not like there was nobody else studying it and they just too figured it out on their own. There were a lot of people trying to get the modern airplane, well, you know, 100 years ago airplane, to actually work and get started, but they couldn't all, none of them were able to figure it out. So the Wright brothers actually sat down, figured out, hey, there's a bunch of misconceptions, bad assumptions, bad data out there. So then they went through the effort to fix everything and put it into, you know, actually implement it. And lo and behold, at Kitty Hawk, they got it to work. So was that more important than the development of, you know, the jet engine or the rocket engine? You know, it's a tough answer, or it's a tough question to answer. Even if you like, I do like the approach of the bigger delta, because that gets the spirit of the matter. But I think that even could be hard to grasp.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like we're talking about an exponential growth curve, right? And so we're trying to assess like where is the slope of that curve the steepest, more or less. And I think I don't know, there'd be like an interesting doctoral thesis almost, right? Where you actually plot out on a time scale and assess like how many lives did this invention impact, right? In that day and then subsequently, right? And kind of build something there. Because
And
I think,
how big were those impacts too?
yeah, but so I think because you're kind of talking about an area under a curve to some extent. And so then, like, the printing press has hundreds and hundreds of years of impact, right? Whereas the internet has, what, 30? And we've already seen a tremendous amount of impact. So it's a question of, like, has the internet already exceeded the impact of books over their whole lifespan that they've been around, you know? And I think the next evolution of that is what we're seeing right now, is the emergence of AI, for good or bad, right? It looks like it's going to be around to stay. And so it's like, how much more does that accelerate? How much more do we accomplish? Because I don't think it's in the way that mechanization has multiplied our physical effort, the ability to transmit information faster and faster has multiplied our intellectual effort, right? So it's like our human effort is a straight line.
Yep.
And then we get this exponential growth curve that we almost need a log scale for to straighten it out, because of how our telecommunications abilities have increased the means by which we can distribute information.
And we talked about that, I think, last episode, where people tend, because you'd think with all of the, like, modern technology, our lives would be so much easier than they used to be. But it turns out it's just as difficult, or maybe just as stressful, or even more stressful than it used to be. And that's because, in general, I think wherever technology says, hey, now the effort that you have to devote to X, Y, or Z is a lot less, we say, great, I'm going to do other stuff with that time and that effort. And you made a really good point last time too, Ben, whereas back in the day, we may have said, well, I'm just going to plow this field for 10 hours. Now it's like, well, I have, rather than one 10-hour thing to do today, I have 10 one-hour things. And mentally, that's a lot more stressful. I can't remember where I was going with that, but
I would agree. Yeah. Like, we're not comparing apple to apple, apples to apple.
Yeah. And to your, like, and I don't have an answer to this, but how would you quantify, you know, how much this invention or this achievement affected humanity or society? It's going to be difficult.
Yeah.
It's going to be subjective metric.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, one thing I think sometimes we maybe overemphasize, for example, the importance of the printing press, at least early on, because when it was invented, there were vast sections of the population that couldn't even read, right? Like, literacy was significantly lower than what it is today, unless you're in the upper classes or, you know, connected to the church in some way. But so, you know, it enabled the distribution of books, but who was there to read them, right? I think it eventually drove higher literacy rates, because now there were books available to read. It was like, oh, there's finally something to make worth my time to become literate, right? If you didn't have anything to read, then why would you care if you could read or not?
Right. There was nothing to read. So why would people bother being literate? Yeah.
But it's kind of a thing where it created its own need in some sense, right? Like, there weren't a whole bunch of people sitting around going, man, I wish I had books to read, you know?
Well, I think there were plenty of people who were trying to acquire books and actually literally writing it out by hand every single time was to begin an inconvenience. So somebody came up with, you know, the printing press to fix that. But I think rather than saying it fed it or it's created its own need, I think I wouldn't say that isn't true. I would say that is true. I think it's maybe an unfair way, although a funny way of looking at it. But I think because it made books more widely available, then it gave people of lower means than just the rich or the church to have the opportunity to read in the first place. So then they felt like, hey, I should read. I wonder if how the development of the car was the same way. Because as they mass produced it, you know, not a lot of people probably were getting along fine without the car. But then as they made more and more of them, as it got cheaper, it then allowed more people to buy cars. Now more people have cars, and now cities have to accommodate cars, and now cities are designed around cars, whereas cities that had been around or had been built before cars were invented, are like their designs are wholly different. So now you need a car in those cities, most of the cities in the US.
You also need a car because I think it was in the 30s or maybe it was post World War II, the automotive industry successfully lobbied a lot of municipalities and US Congress to fund the development of roadways instead of continuing to develop trolley systems and trains and stuff like that. So when we talk, you know, people talk about the difference between public communication or public transportation between the United States and Europe or Asia or whatever, like that's not an accident. That was the automotive industry was like, strong public transportation is not good for us. Why don't we spend our money on automobiles and roadways?
There's a very interesting Vox documentary on YouTube on this specific topic, talking about the comparing the public transportation system in the US versus Europe and Asia. And I think we're kind of in a spiral here where we have these suburbs and residential neighborhoods that are further and further away, and we build bigger and bigger highways to kind of declutter, right, and reduce traffic. But the more we do that, then the more people the more we expand outward, then it just reduces the traffic for a little bit until you have more people living further away. But now they also hop on the highway to try to. But I'd be curious to see how remote work actually maybe helps alleviate some of that remote work and autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. Right, with autonomous vehicles now, in a sense, you have not public transportation, but maybe you have more of a smart system to maybe you can optimize transportation, right? Or for you kind of understand the needs of a city as a whole. For people that may not to be, for example, for us in the office exactly at 8 a.m., maybe you can be there at 10:15 and that's going to help your city. But then while you're in traffic, like you can still take your meetings and stuff like that. Maybe that's I don't know. I'd just be curious to see how that's going to unfold.
I think it'll lead to.
You go, Ben. You go.
I was just going to say, I think it'll lead to. It'll be like Uber or Turo on steroids in some sense, where like. We have meeting rooms that we can book using Microsoft Outlook, right? And you reserve a period of time. I feel like it's going to kind of end up like that where, you know, I use my car, what percentage of my waking hours or of my life do I actually spend in a car? It's not a very large percentage. So if I could defray that cost with, say, 10 neighbors, because we could all schedule out when we needed the car, right? Or bid for windows that are more desirable than others or whatever. I feel like you would be able to reduce the overall number of vehicles and also optimize, kind of the value that you're getting out of cars. But then it becomes more of a commodity, right? Where you're gonna have surge pricing on autonomous vehicles to get to work or get home from work, and you'll have to offset stuff.
And also I feel like another barrier that we'd have to overcome is just culturally, I think we're used to, right, having our own vehicles, and sometimes like logic or rationale doesn't really come into play when it comes down, right? Like it would make sense rationally to have such a system that you just described, but also we're attached to our vehicles. Yeah. We want to have it just in case. I mean, it's very analogous to people that I hear oftentimes people comparing living in the Midwest versus living on the East or West Coast, where there's more things to do. But people that, for example, live on the West Coast, like hardly go to those the museums that they have, or hardly go to the beach or the concerts that they, right? And so I think as humans, we like to have it available at our fingertips, but then hardly leverage it. And I think it's very analogous to this as well. It's like we want to have it available, but we may not like leverage it the way we should. So I don't know, interesting.
I had two thoughts. One of them is, I think a big knock against public transportation in the US is having to give up that independence. If you have your own car, if the roadways or if the country were designed around cars, and that means it's designed for you to go where you want, when you want, You don't have to wait on a train. You don't have to be standing around people on a train. You're on your own. And culturally, I think that's important and much more important in the US, I would assume, than in Europe. And oh, I had another point related to that, but I kind of lost it. However, my second point was in agreement with Kabod's point about the people who have all these amazing places to go to right in their backyard, figuratively speaking, but then they never do, but they want the opportunity. That really, really reminded me of when I was a kid in elementary school, we had assigned seating. And most kids loathed it, or at least like, or at least wished that they had free seating. And then when I was finally in, I think middle school is when we didn't have assigned seating, nor did we in high school, nor did we in college. And what do you see? Everybody usually sits in the same seat every single day, but they still can sit anywhere they want. They just generally don't. But they have the opportunity. They know that they can if they want to. Plus, it also offers the, I may sit in the same seat every day, but now I get to pick where that seat is. It's not like I have to sit three rows and three desks up from my best friend. We may sit in the same spot every day, but now we can sit together. So it still offers some independence, but you're right, where people don't use their independence nearly as much as they say they are going to.
So maybe in defense of people who are in those environments, I think one of the draws of a larger city or places with more amenities, there are a couple of factors. Number one, like say you've got a city with a bunch of great museums. I'm not the kind of person that's going to go like get a membership at a museum and go there once a month. It's like, I'll go through the museum once, look at the highlights that I find interesting. And then I'm like, well, don't need to go there again. And so I think for people who live in a city like that, you could avail yourself of a lot of these like high quality amenities pretty quickly. And then you're just like, well, now I live here and I've seen the stuff to see. And so I think you kind of can check some stuff off that way. But I would also say there to me is an attraction of when you're in a pool of humanity that's that large, you have the opportunity to connect with people who have the same passions and interests. So it's like, okay, if I go move to Denver, I can find hundreds and thousands of people who want to go rock climbing, right? And so I can build a community around that. And maybe we don't do anything else in Denver except rock climb, because that's the amenity that I care about, that I'm the thing that I'm interested in and passionate about. And so I think there's a lot of it where you have people who are living in a city and you ask them like, oh, what sorts of things do you do there? And they might ignore 90 or 95% of all the different things that they could do in the city because they only care about or are interested in a specific portion of it. But they're still getting the benefit of living in a city that they wouldn't get in a small town, right?
That's true.
At least in their mind.
I could dig that.
But one other thought that I had going back to our conversation about public transport and cars and stuff is that I think we sometimes, I'll say in today's day and age, it's easy to vilify wealthy people, right? We hear the term all the time now, the Russian oligarchs, right? And so we assign this label to people who are wealthy and assume that they're all evil and they came by their wealth through nefarious terms, or we'll talk about Jeff Bezos or, you know, Bill Gates or whoever you want to talk about, whoever's got money, they must have cheated, robbed, and stolen to get that money or taken advantage of people, whatever. But I think maybe that's true, but I think sometimes we don't give them enough credit for the ways that they advance things that benefit all of us. And this was going back to the point that you were making, Jack, about the automobile, is that if you think about mass production of anything, if it's mass production of books, mass production of cars, those things existed before, right? There were cars before Henry Ford and the assembly line. There were books before the printing press. What changed was how available they were and what their cost was. Mm-hmm. So there's all those sorts of like luxury goods or whatever your category is for those items. Those always exist. and wealthy people will have the means to get their hands on them. But through their investment, through their creating a market for those things, somebody goes, oh, I could make a bunch of money because people are willing to pay for it if I made more of these things. And so it's essentially through the demand generated by the wealthy that mass production becomes viable. And then that mass production makes it viable for all the rest of us to have the same thing that the wealthy people had. Right.
I remember when Teslas were, you know, unobtainable to your average person. Like that, if you see, you saw somebody driving around in Tesla, that you know they were rolling in it. But because Tesla was able to sell enough of those cars, they then generated the money to now make the cars more accessible to people. I don't actually know how much a Tesla costs now. I would assume it's still relatively expensive, but it's within reach of the general population. Maybe not in a comfortable spot, but it's now no longer like above the clouds. Now it's like, okay, it's still high, but you know, not like it's getting within affordable range for Joe Schmo. I think that's speculation. You know, I would look up how much Tesla costs, but that would go against the spirit of the podcast.
It's like 35K, 35 to 40.
What? Like that. That's it?
That's yeah, it. For the lowest model.
But yeah. Still, like your average yeah. pickup is like 50K new.
That's maybe. Probably more than that. Yeah, I was just riding with someone on a road trip last week, and he said that the cost of like an Escalade, a new Escalade, I think is $120,000 or something like that.
Wow.
At least in the part of Texas that he's in.
Granted, it is an Escalade, but still.
It's still pretty wild.
That is still very wild.
And another point that I would say back on the topic of public transportation, and so maybe it wouldn't be intra-city, but inter-city, would be that the U.S. is a continent, you know, right, compared to like France or countries in Europe that are smaller than our states here, mm-hmm. Or maybe the size of a state. So I think we're dealing with and the example that they bring up in that Vox documentary is them trying to build a high speed train from might have been from L.A. to maybe Vegas. And then they have to go through so many counties and get so many approvals and go through so many, like maybe private land and yep. that it becomes, they have to go through litigation after litigation to try to get approval. And it's just not worth the time. Whereas I feel like maybe in Europe, that might be a little bit easier. I don't know if that's cultural or not, but. Again, there's some hurdles that we have to overcome here.
And does the U.S. have a lot more levels of government than Europe or other parts of the world? Because we have federal, state, county, city.
Yep, I think we do. I think we do.
I would say more, not that there are necessarily more levels, but that the authority granted to each level is more evenly distributed across the layers
in the U.S. than it is elsewhere generally.
Yeah. Yes. Because I would say, at least my understanding and perception is that like in Europe, there would be more authority in the higher levels of government. Whereas your local like town or village or whatever might be primarily symbolic, right? Like it's technically a government, but they don't really have any authority.
Gotcha.
One other thing that they bring up in that documentary is, it is given the number of approvals that need to get, that it extends the timeline of the project. Mm-hmm. And then generally what happens is we also have, you know, Democrats versus Republicans kind of being in power, and the funding for public transportation also shifts during mm-hmm. that time. Yeah. And so then it just throws another variable in the equation there, and which makes it a little bit harder as well. So interesting.
So, I mean, you're talking about, because like I think there's two factors that come up with the U.S. being as large as it is. Is one, that's just, it just means it's going to be more expensive to build those train lines, and we're going to have to need more of them because our country is so much larger than France or Great Britain or Germany alone. But two, because our government is more evenly distributed, now we're going to have to be doing with a lot more red tape to get those lines built. And we already have the interstate system set up. And at least for cargo, like trains would be less efficient from getting cargo from point A to point B than trucks would, because trucks can just go from point A to point B on the roads. But to get things from point A to point B with the train, you may have to load it and unload it a couple times. And very likely, particularly for small towns, the train probably just doesn't even stop there in the first place. So you're going to have to load it on a truck anyway.
So one factor that plays into that, my brother-in-law is German, and he's talked about how their rail networks. So in the U.S., we have very, like, Amtrak is notorious for being late, right? They never hit their schedules.
Yeah.
And so he was talking about how our rail networks prioritize freight at the expense of moving people, whereas, like, German rail networks prioritize getting people to and from places, the public transportation element, at the cost of freight. And so this a few years ago, they were having, I think their water levels were really low in the Rhine River. And so they're having problems. That's one of their primary shipping lanes. And they were having problems like getting cargo north to south in Germany.
And they were using river barges, I assume.
Yeah. So that that river is heavily trafficked with barges, similar to like what the Mississippi would be, but probably even more so.
Right.
He was talking about how the impact, the immediate impact that that had on their rail network, because, you know, they're continuing to prioritize getting people from city to city. And so their rail network can't absorb any of that cargo or freight load that the barges were taking care of. So it's, you know, there are trade-offs for any system, right? And so I think it's easy for us to look at what we have and say, oh man, I wish we had what they had, but it's not necessarily better, it's different, right? And we have things that our system does better, and they have things that their system does better. And I remember in college, I went to school in Northwest Indiana, and there's oil refineries and massive steel mills there, and it is an eyesore. But someone made the point to me that there are a lot of countries in the world that would literally go to war to have that kind of infrastructure available to them, right? And so it's, again, it's a trade-off. Like, yes, it's an eyesore and nobody wants to have it in their backyard, but having that capability to refine oil and produce our own steel is of a huge benefit to our society overall. And so...
Where did you say that site was?
Northwest Indiana. So between like Whiting and Portage or Port of Indiana.
Okay. I don't know those towns, but
it's basically the Lake Michigan shoreline on the Indiana shore there between Illinois and Michigan.
If it's Northwest Indiana and it's on Lake Michigan, how close is it to Gary?
Yeah, Gary's in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Yep.
I remember when I came back from the Twin Cities last weekend, and I drove down 52 through Rochester rather than going down I-35. And there is this giant, I don't know what it is. It looks either like a chemical refinery or a power plant. I don't know what it is. It's so ugly but so cool at the same time. Ben, you're shaking your head. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, we drove past it on our way back from Boundary Waters.
Oh man, I love driving by that thing. I gotta look into it someday, but man, it is huge and so cool. But yeah, I like looking at things like that.
It looks like some sort of a refinery, whether it's oil or natural gas or whatever, but I mean there are so many towers and like the I don't remember what they call them, but the like blow-off torches, you know, that are always burning.
Oh, stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Methane.
But, yeah. But I hate to put a damper on things. I think we're closing in on an hour and a half here, so probably need to wrap things up.
Late.
Yeah. So
time flew.
Yeah,
thanks for joining us, Kabod, and like I said, I think it'd be cool to have you and Mahawish both on, and we can revive the twins topic in a future episode.
For sure, for sure. I'd certainly appreciate the opportunity, and looking forward to joining you guys again sometime in the near future.
I like it. We'll be in touch.
Cool. Yeah. And I'll be listening to this one.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you don't like listening to your own voice.
Even though I don't like listening to myself.
Yeah. You're podcast famous now, so.
I am. All 200,000 people.
Yes. You know, if you just say it enough, right, and believe it,
yes,
it's going to come true. That's how it works.
Speak your reality into the universe.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening in this week. Again, if you would like to join us, as Kubo did, as a guest on the podcast, we do have a link to sign up in the description of both our podcast itself and each episode that we publish. So you can just click the link. It takes you to a Google form. I think there's maybe 3 questions to fill out, and then we'll get in contact with you to schedule a time to join us as a guest. So if you'd like to do that, or if you have any other suggestions, topic ideas, things we could do to improve, we'd love to hear those as well. So until next time, take care.